the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Good Monday morning. We've talked a bit about agriculture crime recently on our show. Well, if you live in the San Joaquin County area and have been a victim of rural crime or want to prevent things like that from happening, you should have a no trespass letter on file with your local county sheriff's department. A no trespass sign helps combat homeless encampments and activists from coming onto your property. If you don't live in the San Joaquin County area, you should contact your local sheriff's department to see if the no trespass rule is applicable in your region. Moving on to what's happening in today's show, Brian German is talking with us about the Organic Research Foundation grant deadline that's coming up, as well as a rice weed course that's also nearing. You'll hear about agriculturalists defining sustainability in agriculture, and Taylor Hillman has details on the EPA claiming California glyphosate labeling as misleading. But first, I'm starting off the show today with some more news on, you guessed it, the trade war with China. Let's jump right in. As the trade war escalates and the tariffs are costing more farmers more money, the agriculture community is looking for answers to what's going to come from this. Earlier this week, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue confidently told farmers they will regain access to the markets they've lost during the trade war with China. Approximately when those markets will open back up, well, that's still up for debate. According to the Associated Press, Perdue was at a Minnesota trade show and was the key guest at a listening session with U.S. House Agriculture Committee Chairman Colin Peterson. Perdue answered questions from farmers who were concerned about the trade war's long-term effects and how their livelihoods depend on the future of farming. Perdue added that markets come and go and are not irreplaceable. He added that the U.S. is currently working on opening other markets in India, Thailand, Indonesia, and Malaysia. Last week, President Trump told reporters, quote, "As to whether or not a deal will be made, I will tell you this. China would like to make a deal very badly." Perdue ended his session in Minnesota with support for the American farmer, stating, quote, "Obviously, there's a lot of stress out there, not only over farm prices and trade, but also labor, adding weather onto that. But it's a great constituency. Farmers are resilient, and we want to do everything we can to help them not only survive, but thrive." And now here's Taylor Hillman with more agriculture news.
Labeling glyphosate as a possible cause of cancer is coming to an end. The Environmental Protection Agency ruled last week that glyphosate should not be required to be labeled as cancer-causing. The EPA said they will not approve any products with such labeling because of what they said is a false claim that does not meet the labeling requirements of the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. California has required such labeling under the heavily scrutinized Proposition 65 law, which calls for cancer warnings on a laundry list of products. EPA's Administrator Andrew Wheeler said in a release, quote, "It is irresponsible to require labels on products that are inaccurate when EPA knows the product does not pose a cancer risk. We will not allow California's flawed program to dictate federal policy. It's critical that federal regulatory agencies like EPA relay to consumers accurate, science-based information about risks that pesticides may pose to them." Wheeler went on to say that the EPA's notification to glyphosate registrants is an important step to ensuring the information shared with the public on a federal pesticide label is correct and not misleading. Proposition 65 is largely based off of data from the International Agency on the Research for Cancer, which said glyphosate is, quote, "probably carcinogenic to humans." EPA stated that their independent evaluation of available scientific data included a more extensive and relevant data set, which they found glyphosate to be, quote, "not likely to be carcinogenic to humans." Glyphosate registrants with Prop 65 warnings have 90 days to amend and submit new labeling. I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
This year's rice weed course is coming up on Friday, September 6th at Hamilton Road Field in Biggs. UC Rice Farm Advisor for Sutter, Yuba, Placer, and Sacramento counties, Whitney Brim DeForest, said the course will be a hands-on event covering a multitude of topics.
So we'll be out in the field and folks will get a chance to go out and look at the trials. So that's always a good opportunity for CCAs and growers to see what the new herbicides are that are coming down the pipeline and, you know, other ideas for weed control. We'll also be covering weedy rice, but not in great detail. We'll do regulation updates with the Rice Commission. And then we'll be focusing on grass control this year a lot because that seems to be a big topic for folks. And we also do a hands-on weed ID session, and that's pretty well received in the past. So we'll have a bunch of weeds out for people to take a look at IDing. We have a quiz and everything. It's a fun interactive session.
The deadline to submit letters of intent for 2020 grant funding from the Organic Farming Research Foundation is coming up on Friday, August 16th. Farmers, ranchers, graduate students, and extension personnel are all encouraged to apply for funding. The Organic Farming Research Foundation grants program is open to all applicants residing and conducting research in Canada, Mexico, and the United States. The grant program provides funding for research on organic farming, ranching, and food systems, and also supports the dispersal of research results to organic producers. Proposals will need to involve farmers or ranchers in project design and implementation and are required to take place on certified organic land. The OFRF grant funding has helped to advance scientific knowledge and improve the practices, ecological sustainability, and economic prosperity of organic production. Successful applicants will be notified during the fall and will be invited to submit a full proposal. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
USDA's Food and Nutrition Service is marking its milestone 50th anniversary.
In thinking about this 50th anniversary, I got to thinking the fact that the motto we've adopted, you are the guys that fulfill that motto.
That was Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue. The motto is Do Right and Feed Everyone, which describes the FNS programs.
Not only is it really a safety net, a support, but a springboard, I think, for all of our agencies. You know, you begin with birth at WIC. And for mothers and infants, they are youngest Americans having the nutrition they need. And then school meals and summer programs, we've learned how important they are.
FNS runs the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, as well as the Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion.
USDA is revered and trusted in the opinion and advice that it gives. And we have to use that platform of respect and credibility.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
As the amount of litigation continues to increase, Bayer AG has indicated that the company has not ruled out the possibility for a settlement related to glyphosate. There are currently ongoing lawsuits from more than 18,000 plaintiffs in connection to the weed killer Roundup, with a significant increase in litigation in just the past 3 months. During a conference call with analysts, Bayer Chief Executive Officer Werner Baumann said that, quote, in general, we will of course only consider settlement if financially reasonable and if we can achieve finality of the overall litigation. Throughout the lawsuits, Bayer has pointed to extensive scientific evidence which has found glyphosate to be safe when used according to instructions. In a written statement, the company has stated, quote, Bayer continues to believe that it has meritorious defenses and intends to defend itself vigorously in all of these lawsuits. In parallel to the continued litigation, Bayer will constructively engage in the mediation process. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Well, in today's livestock news, we told you last week that the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and Public Lands Council had launched a digital campaign focused on the value of grazing. The digital campaign was created to explore key elements of grazing that benefit the environment, rural communities, and local economies across the U.S. Ethan Lane of NCBA and PLC explains what the group's new media campaign, The Value of Grazing, is all about.
This campaign is about highlighting the good work we accomplish through using grazing on the landscape, whether that's in the West, whether that's in the Midwest, whether that's on pasture, whether that's on range. There's a tremendous amount of value derived from grazing livestock animals in those environments. And our members are all nodding their heads and saying, well, yeah, of course there are a tremendous amount of benefits, but the rest of the country needs to know more about that. Congress needs to know more about that. Some of the conservation groups and environmental groups that we work with need to have a better understanding of some of that. And particularly in the middle of wildfire season, where we have some of those examples playing out in real time, we thought it was a really good opportunity to just kind of throw a big net over that issue and really help people understand the positive impacts that we have.
Now, the four-week campaign includes a video and blog post featuring California rancher Rich Atmore from just outside of the Ventura area. He lived through the destructive 2017 Thomas Fire, and here are some of his comments about it.
And that fire come down that canyon like a cyclone, spinning from side of the canyon to side of the canyon. 80, 85 mile an hour winds. About that time, the embers started coming. And I mean, it was an ember shower like I've never seen before. Embers the size of your thumb were just flying, landing in the pocket of your coat, lighting your coat pocket on fire. And we really had a mess going. And for about 10 hours, we stayed there and fought that fire. 500 houses to the east of that area that hadn't been grazed in 30 years, almost completely burned to the ground, that neighborhood. And 500 people lost their homes. Across the rest of the ranch, we managed all the way across the rest of Ventura. Yeah, there were some homes that burned down from embers, but 95% of the homes that burned down were because of the pastures that weren't grazed. And most all the homes adjacent to the pastures that were grazed were saved. And there were some that burned down from embers, but it wasn't anything like on the other side that was ungrazed. So I can't preach anything more to my urban neighbors than the fact that grazing's what helps protect you. Because without us, this vegetation would have been four times as thick and the damage would have been four times as bad.
Now, Atmore was able to use livestock grazing to mitigate the intensity and damage of wildfires around his home and surrounding urban landscapes. Now, the Value of Grazing campaign will continue to share impactful stories like that about the importance of livestock grazing throughout the month of August. This effort will take place through social media content, online blog posts, and videos. You can learn more on the National Cattlemen's Beef Association website, ncba.org, or go to the Public Lands Council website, publiclandscouncil.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
A major association again leaves its mark on a local community's food supply. The Produce Marketing Association's Food Service Conference and Expo took place last month in Monterey. Once again, many of the 201 exhibitors paid it forward before leaving Monterey County. PMA said that exhibitors donated 17,833 pounds of fresh fruits and vegetables to the Food Bank of Monterey County, a nonprofit organization that collects, stores, and distributes donated food to 1 in 5 residents in the area. The Food Bank's executive director, Melissa Kendrick, said, quote, "It's through partnerships with industries like the fresh produce industry that the Food Bank of Monterey County is able to provide access to critical, nutrition-packed foods our residents need the most. The Monterey County Food Bank distributes 7 million pounds of food annually, feeding over 10,000 people per week." I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
There are a variety of occupations in the workforce where income doesn't come in on a regular basis.
Those kinds of positions could be either seasonal positions, or they could be the kind of job where a person is sometimes getting tips, or they may be earning commissions.
Self-employment also qualifies as careers with irregular income, according to just recently retired Colorado State University Extension financial expert Laurel Kubin. If you find yourself in that type of job situation, you can plan accordingly to get through the lean months and perhaps save some during times when extra income comes in. CSU Extension financial expert Glenda Wentworth says first,
calculate their minimum monthly amount that they can count on coming in, and then also calculate that amount of expenses that they have every month.
Now, to clarify, minimum monthly income means that money you know for sure, not assume, you get regularly on a monthly basis. Likewise, Wentworth says the focus of expenses should be on those for essential living, housing, food, insurance, perhaps transportation.
Any of your contractual agreements that you've had, those have to be either the highest priorities that you use for your expenditures every month. Looking at those fixed expenses that are the same every month, your housing, your car payments.
Wentworth says monitoring of the income, expenses, and budget on a monthly basis is essential when on an irregular income.
One of the most helpful things for people to do is to track their spending habits. And even if you can track that for a month and down to every dollar that you're spending, then you really have a sense of where your money is going. And if you need to use some of that money for something else, then you can look at where have I been spending my money and where can I cut that money instead of spending it on eating out or my coffee that I pick up every day.
Laurel Kubin says when income is irregular, paying yourself first, better known as saving, during times when monthly income is greater than the minimum, is important to assist in the leaner months. A rule of thumb is building up the savings fund over time to an amount that would cover at least 1 month, preferably 3 to 6 months, worth of essential expenses.
You also need to look at not overspending during those good times when there is more coming in.
Also set some of that extra income aside for retirement or education funds. And Glenda Wentworth adds,
you should use credit cautiously. Credit is for an emergency. Just charging what you can afford to pay in full at the end of each month is critical.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
How to raise your own queen bees. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. It can be easy to purchase your queen bees online or from local breeders, but there are also some valid reasons you should consider rearing queen bees yourself. If you raise your own queens, your starting cost will be minimal, anywhere from $15 to $25, and you can continue to raise queens for minimal cost over and over again. If you plan to buy locally and you know there is a keeper nearby that has a constant flow of new queen bees, then supply and demand may not be an issue. When you decide to begin rearing a new queen will depend on what you need for her or how soon you will need her. However, if you're not in a hurry, the summer months are usually the best time of year to rear queens due to the high activity of the hives and warmer temperatures. Make sure you have all the necessary tools to get started, such as extra nooks, grafting tool, magnifying glass, smoker, and protective gear. It's also important to research the best method that beekeepers use to rear their own queens, such as grafting, the Genterkit method, splitting the hive, and using queen castles. Depending upon the method you have used, there will be a few loose ends to tie up once your queen has hatched. It's important to reiterate the importance of keeping queen cells that are ready to hatch separated. Remember, queen bees hatch in only 16 days' time, so be sure to document everything. I'm Kathy Isom for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. So my recipe today is a vegetable noodle ratatouille with a lemon gastrique. Now the gastrique, you don't have to necessarily have. If some people don't want lemon, it's totally okay. But to make the gastrique, it's very simple. All I take is a quarter cup of lemon juice, 2 tablespoons of sugar, and I reduce that down by just half. I hit it with some heavy cream, and it's good to go. It's a very, very simple recipe and a nice little sauce that accompanies these vegetables. Now these are all julienne cut. The way I do that is using a julienne peeler. If you don't have a julienne peeler, it's okay. You can do this a julienne old-fashioned way, pretty much cutting these into very thin strips and making sure they're flat when you cut them. And it's not difficult to do. It is challenging. So my advice to you, if you're going to do it this way, just make sure that you do it the right way, because it doesn't take a long time for these vegetables to cook at all. They cook absolutely quick. We're talking 45 seconds in a hot saute pan, and they are good to go. I do 1 red bell pepper, 1 Spanish onion. Well, I'll do about a half a Spanish onion. You could do the full Spanish onion. If you don't like onion, at least do half or a quarter. It's important. 1 green zucchini, 1 crooked neck zucchini, which are the yellow zucchinis, 1 eggplant, preferably a Japanese eggplant if you can get one. If not, an eggplant will suffice well. If you're going to use a whole eggplant, though, I highly recommend only using about a quarter of that, because the flavor is very, very important when you're making a ratatouille. 1 cup of tomato pulp to taste Italian seasoning and to taste salt and pepper. Put this in a hot skillet with 3 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 tablespoon of butter. Once it goes into the skillet, immediately season with your Italian seasoning and your salt and pepper. This does not take long at all. If you're going to use the gastrique, all you're simply going to need to do is pour the gastrique over this and toss it. After 45 seconds, you could leave it in the pan, but turn the heat off and remove the pan from the heat. So put it to a different side of the stove, or take it off the stove completely. We don't want this to overcook, and I highly recommend that you serve this immediately, because if not, what ends up happening is the vegetables get really mushy and it's really not very appetizing. For this and many more of my untamed recipes, go to my website, www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Chef Albert. the Untamed Chef for AgNatWest.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNatWest. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNatWest Farm City News Day. I'm Danielle Leal. Today's interview segment comes from our friends at agwired.com. It's the first portion of a panel discussion where each panelist defines the word sustainability in agriculture. Let's take a listen.
I will start today's panel. My name is Willie Vogt. I'm the editorial director at Farm Progress. More about me in a moment. I want to welcome you today to Data Drives Sustainable Solutions, a panel discussion about the way data is being put together on the farm. And I think it's important to think about today's farm as a technology hub, that we're relying on real-time data today to increase yields, profitability, and evaluate the efficacy of solutions that we're putting to work on the operation. Around the globe, though, farmers are increasing their use of precision agriculture in new ways using remote sensing, weather, soil data to run their operations. And that tech has more opportunity to increase the sustainability of agriculture in new ways. And that's what we're going to explore today. I'm honored to have with me today on the panel three distinguished and knowledgeable speakers. First, my immediate left is Stephen Ward. He's the Senior Director of Geospatial and Weather Science. I thought I had a long title. Anyway, Dr. Ward works as the Director of Data Insights and Discovery at Climate. He's based in San Francisco, California. You picked a good time to come to Minnesota. Don't come in January. He currently leads a research team that includes remote sensing scientists, geographers, statisticians, meteorologists, and artificial intelligence specialists conducting advanced research in areas of remote sensing. Those are all job titles that didn't exist in agriculture a decade ago. I'm just going to go with that. So anyway, to his left is Pat Christie, who's the founder of Conservice. He's got more than 25 years of experience taking ideas and building them into something of value. He knows how to start from nothing and make something, and he's got a long, he calls himself a serial entrepreneur, and I think that his success rate shows that it works. And Pat, we appreciate that. He is the founder of Conservice, which he started in 2008 to focus on enterprise sustainability and to solve meaningful problems for farmers. And Conservice takes a little different approach to that, and he'll explain that when he talks. And then for some real world, real time value to this panel, on the far end is Justin Stock. He's a farmer from Fergus Falls, Minnesota. He farms just outside the Red River Valley, so he's a corn and soybean operator, and he also apparently enjoys fishing and hockey. That's good for you, because you're up there and there's a lot of ice. Yes. That's great. Okay. So first off, I really want to start by asking each of the panelists to share a little more about their background, and then also, I guess, because we have the magic word in the title of this, why don't each of you also define for the group here what you think sustainability means? So, Dr. Ward?
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for being here and listening to us, everyone. I appreciate it. A little more about my background, come education-wise, chemistry, agronomy, and spatial statistics. The confluence of all of those seems to make sense at Climate now, and it's put me in the position I'm in. Prior to that, I'm about a 20-year geospatial technology industry veteran, if you will, coming out of the government intelligence sector. So I've actually been able to bring over quite a bit of that work into what we do at Climate, which really relies heavily on the fusion of multiple data sources, multiple data feeds, and really intelligence, and really bring to life what we collectively call internally agricultural intelligence, or AgInt. And it's really what we're practicing. And one of the key pillars of that is now sustainability. And sustainability is a very loaded word. It's a dangerous word at times. It's polymorphic in definition. And it runs the risk of being misused and overused. And so from our perspective, it's got three legs of the stool. And it's one being an economic or temporal aspect. It's the ability of someone like Justin to continue farming, have freedom to operate, and pass that operation on to his children or family or whomever he chooses. The second piece is very much a social piece, and it's the social and stewardship and responsibility that we as an organization have to our farmers, to the general public, to consumers. And then the third piece is, of course, the environmental piece, and one which is most often thought of when we talk about sustainability. But to talk about one independently, one leg of the stool, is, in our opinion, really the incorrect approach. And we really have to consider all three at one time. And part of my new role at Climate is helping bring a lot of the sustainability commitments of the broader Bayer organization to life through digital tools.
Pat Christie, I don't know if I can live up to the introduction. I'll do my best. I like to tell people I couldn't get a job, so I had to start a company. Anyways, so had the fortune of getting into high tech in the early part of the 90s. I was part of the transformation of the dot-com boom. Ended up in the working to build the private network for the Navy, which brought us into large-scale infrastructure to aggregate data across 300 bases in the U.S. Eventually went to Europe, lived in Europe, lived in Belgium for 3 years doing the same thing for the NATO. And when we lived in Europe, what was interesting is the carbon explosion was real, right? There was a cap-and-trade environment that was emerging, and we started to see this happening in the U.S. And so when we launched Conservus, it was actually the idea that conservation or sustainability is doing more with less. You can't improve what you can't measure, and that the foundation of sustainable practices begins at the economics. You know, if you're not making money, it doesn't matter what your impact imperative could be, you're not going to survive. And so how do you do that? So we started to say you need to collect the fundamental business data across an operational cycle, and when you do that properly, you'll be able to create options with that information. One option could be a greenhouse gas report. It could be a carbon offset that's created. And frankly, at the farm level, it could be understanding cost of production by crop, by field, by acre, by zone. I was fortunate to start Conservus with some really smart people. Remember, whenever you start a business, find people smarter than you. I try to do that often. Our head of technology was the head of emerging tech at Cargill, who brought a breadth of experience around agricultural data sets. And our head of sustainability actually came out as a merchandiser. He was a trader at Pillsbury and eventually managed a supply chain globally in ag products. And it was through those two that we actually got introduced to farmers who found us and said, we have a need. We're trying to figure out how to organize our operation for access to capital, access to new markets, and as a consequence, we think if we can protect and preserve our practices, we might be able to get paid for doing things in a certain way. And that's where we started. So sustainability, doing more or less at the farm level, and it starts with an economic foundation.
I'm Justin Stock. I guess I'm the dumb farmer on the panel, but I'm part of a multi-generational farm in West Central Minnesota. It's myself, my sister, and my dad who basically run the farm, and we raise corn and soybeans. I'd probably be considered what the industry would call an early adopter. So we typically adopt new technologies when we deem they fit. That was when I went to college at the University of Illinois. My parents said that I had to go away for a certain period of time to experience something else, although Illinois didn't seem that much different than...
I wasn't going to say anything, but yeah.
But I kind of think back to that time when I first went to college was when auto steer technology came out, and we adopted that. And when I came home to the farm, that was something that was very integral to the farm. And then after that came section control technology, and those have kind of been the benchmarks of what we use in the field today. We still use them pretty much in every application. But since that time period, in the last 5 to 10 years, there's been we've started mapping yields, collecting all this data, and now basically where the technology comes in is we're trying to figure out what to do with this data and how to do it efficiently and how to do it smartly. And, so that comes into the sustainability portion of where we're trying to increase our yields every year and do it at a rate faster than other people are doing. But we're also trying to figure out how to do it with less and more concise inputs and trying to define that, if we're putting nitrogen on the field, nitrogen isn't just nitrogen. There's other aspects of nitrogen, what form it is and how to leverage that and harness it and use it for what the plant wants rather than what's cheap and easy for the farmer. So I think there's a growing revolution in agriculture right now that we need to be a lot more smart with use more intelligence with our inputs. And part of that in the state of Minnesota is coming down through government regulation. Minnesota is more of a progressive state on deciding what they deem is sustainable for farmers to do. So in the last couple of years, we've been adopting practices on our farm where we're trying to get ahead of the curve. So when the regulation comes in, we want to be running with our farm when other people are trying to figure out how do we farm now with these new regulations. So it's an important topic, and I'm just really honored to be here to talk about some of the challenges we're facing and letting people like you hear a voice from the farm and what we're trying to do with all this data and sustainability.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now. As we celebrate 75 years of Smokey the Bear, we might think, where did Smokey the Bear come from and why was he needed? USDA Stephanie Ho has the report.
Smokey Bear's 75th birthday provides an opportunity to look back to World War II when firefighting was tied to national security.
A Japanese campaign of incendiary balloons started forest fires in some of our western states.
Forest Service Chief Vicki Christensen says Smokey and his fire prevention awareness campaign were created in 1944 as part of the Cooperative Forest Fire Prevention Program.
The program launched a campaign to make fire prevention a matter of civic pride and patriotism.
More than seven decades later,
Smokey has appeared not only in posters, but also in song and story, on radio and TV, and as a living symbol at the National Zoo.
He also makes personal appearances
with celebrities at events such as parades, rodeos, and baseball games.
Christensen says Smokey the Bear still needs help in raising public awareness for wildfire prevention.
He and his signature phrase, "Only you can prevent wildfires," is truly iconic. Though Smokey has been essential to the reduction of unwanted human-caused wildfires over the last 75 years, he still needs help. Even today, nearly 9 out of 10 wildfires nationwide are caused by people. Based on 2008 through 2017 figures, more than 60,000 wildfires start each year through human carelessness, which on average about 8,500 fires are started by lightning. 60,000 human-caused, 8,500 natural-caused.
And in more agriculture news, a report provided by the California Farm Bureau Federation says that cilantro has been used in traditional medicine to treat against seizures. And University of California research has found the underlying action that allows the herb to have that effect. Scientists at UC Irvine says this new understanding may lead to improvement in treatments for seizures. The study identified a particular component of cilantro that reduced what the lead researcher called, quote, cellular excitability.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgNetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgNetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City News Day by AgNet West.